trial comes up. Supposing in that deposition that a witness has made a statement, a year later the trial occurs, and he says something different. There are two inconsistent statements. Nobody picks it up. The verdict comes in, or the judge makes his decision, and then the district attorney, there's been no retraction of any kind. The district attorney takes the, or some attorney takes the statement in the deposition, statement in the transcript on trial. There's been no retraction. That guy's guilty as hell under this. And it may be there hasn't been any study or investigation of the circumstances, and the whole thing could be explained. And had it been brought to his attention, perhaps he would have retracted.
Furthermore, Mr. Chairman, what is an inconsistent statement? The hypotheticals we've been talking about here are nice and clean and neat. You know, the light was red, the light was green. But suppose you get into, well, the light was yellow on the deposition. And then he says on trial, well, it was just turning red. Are those inconsistent?
Well,
that's all
you got.
You'll talk about it.
Chairman,
or suppose even more. Suppose he says 8:45 on the deposition, and he says 9:00 at the time of trial. Is that inconsistent?
Well, it depends on how important the difference was. He said, I looked at my watch and it said 8:47. I remember it and I got a mental picture of that, 8:47 there on my watch. And on the trial, he said, I looked at my watch and it was 10:47.
I moved the table, so.
You still have to have the intention of the mind to make it pretty clear.
That's a non-debatable motion.
The Attorney General has moved that we table Section 7. It's a non-debatable.
Judy, your persuasive argument.
It's non-debatable.
Where's the roll?
Where's the quorum?
Well, we got a quorum.
Everybody in favor of tabling, say aye when you name your call those opposed.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Carson? Chandler?
No.
Martin is here. Frost?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Bernstead's not here. Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
No.
Spalding?
No.
Young?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Chairman? Aye. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Against 3. Motion is carried.
I knew sooner or later we'd get down to the point where I was on the minority again.
Section 8.
Section 8, page 46. Initiating a false report. A person commits a crime of initiating a false report if he knowingly initiates a false alarm or report to be transmitted to a fire department, law enforcement agency, or other organization that deals with emergencies involving danger to life or property.
Who will read that?
Chairman, I have a question.
Judge Burns.
What is an organization that deals with emergencies other than an ambulance?
Fire department, police department.
How about
Federal Aviation Administration?
How about the Sunshine Division of the Portland Fire Department? Which
financial emergencies of the poor people?
Emergencies at Christmas time for poor little kids and unfed families. Is that a,
what about the
those aren't dangers to life or property, are they?
Sure they are.
Immediate dangers to life or property.
What about a self-composed vigilante committee that's organized in the neighborhood because children have been molested or something? Is that the same thing?
Well, that sort of thing wasn't intended to be.
You intended to be official organization.
Yeah, all civil organizations. An officially recognized organization.
Oh, wouldn't that be a question of matter of proof as to whether an organization would want to be
emerging
as anything else?
That language was intended to cover the unofficial type of organization as well as official. This was one of the things discussed in the subject.
And if it's an ed-type organization, there is some reason for it.
And I think there should be some leeway in that area.
Mm-hmm. You had a volunteer type of organization that dealt with this kind of emergency. The danger to persons and the legitimate interest there to be protected is calling out these rules without justification. That was really the reason, Judge.
Well, I just wanted to make some legislative history on it. I would agree with that. I think that's a good idea, but I wanted to make sure that the minutes show that's what it was intended.
Question.
Senator Burns, before we put the question, do you have something that...
Well, I just wanted to make sure that the legislative history does show this. Now, I thought you started out by suggesting, Jim, that it should only be official. Is that...
No, I didn't suggest whether it should be one or the other. I wanted to know the scope of it.
Call the roll.
Is this an adoption of the whole thing as it stands?
Yes.
Could we? I would move that we amend the motion, and the amendment would be to delete the words or other organizations deals with emergency involving the danger of life and property, and inserting after the department and to amend it strictly to fire and law enforcement. Taking out of the area the unknown sunshine position.
Did you hear the discussion? You were here during the discussion on organizations that. Don't you think that if there is an organization in Portland, Salem? Pardon? It doesn't require a second. If there is an organization that's unofficial, perhaps, but recognized, that deals in this sort of thing, that a report to them, which puts in the process the same thing as being reported to a police or a fire, don't you think that should be covered?
Like the Minutemen?
No,
yeah,
like
the
ambulance.
What about the mountain rescue team?
What about
the
mountain rescue team? Always falls off civil defense or whatever they call it.
Yeah, the civil defense agency.
Or a forest protection association.
Forest fire people. Then it would be a matter of proof in that prosecution as to whether or not that was the type of organization.
Mr. Chairman, after hearing the discussion following my amendment, I withdraw my amendment. My ego won't take another one.
Call the roll.
Well, you're not a prosecutor.
You make your point well.
Jeff Burns.
Aye.
Sandy Burns.
Aye.
Carson. Chandler.
Aye.
Ross.
No.
Haas.
Aye.
Not too well.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spalding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
I'll change back. Aye.
Section 9 on page 51.
Criminal impersonation. A person commits a crime of criminal impersonation if with intent to obtain a benefit or to injure or defraud another, he falsely impersonates a public servant and doesn't act in such assumed character.
Public servant is defined.
Well, it works for the state.
Or city government.
Why does it have to be a public servant, Roger?
Well, because...
Because I would be killed so frequently otherwise. I cough up and say, I'm Burns, Senator Burns. How about this or that?
Yeah. What about the schizophrenic personality?
Oh, you'll note on page 56, we have a proliferation of statutes. Decided as a matter of policy that many of these statutes were special interest statutes and didn't require continuance in criminal law, particularly when you're talking about impersonating a member of a private organization like the Elks or the Military. American Legion.
Well, there's some...
This doesn't cover the ounce or the moose, does it?
You eliminate the section, you would eliminate...
Of course, we do have a problem
in impersonating members of private organizations. They're all, see these guys come through here and sell advertising in law enforcement journals that have no circulation and no, nothing in fact to back them up.
Obtaining money by false pretense, that's theft by deception.
Now they'd be able to be brought under the theft by deception thing. Previously, they wouldn't, because the only thing that they were representing would be false is themselves. And of course, that is not, you yourself cannot be a false token.
All right, we've taken care of that one.
Roger, what would happen to those statutes?
It would be repealed.
Yeah, right.
At least, for example, 165-340, pretending to be a member or agent of a religious or charitable organization, as long as there was no conduct showing identity fraud, that would no longer be a crime. In which you could go around town telling everyone you were an elk and a member of the local Elks Lodge.
What if the...
If you went to solicit money on behalf of the Elks, representing that you were representing them, acting on their behalf, you would be guilty under theft.
Well, what if you use that for the purpose of gaining entry?
To the Elks?
Yeah.
That would not be a crime.
How about a police officer who impersonates himself as being elk, goes in and raids a slot machine?
Well, that's not injuring or defrauding another, is it?
Mr. Chairman?
There's something about, though, someone misrepresenting himself and gaining entry to elks or shriners that seems wrong to me.
In fact, it's done quite often, really, and whenever I've seen it done. Whenever the manager of something of the organization becomes aware of it, he asks me to leave. I've never known him to call the police.
Could I inquire of Judge Byrne if you
could make a phone call?
Were you checking on the deceptive practices, Brad?
No, I wanted to check and make sure on this public servant we're using the definition from the bribery section. That was something I wasn't sure about. I wanted to make sure.
Well, don't we have a draft on fraud and deception or something like this? Fraud and deceptive practices?
Yeah, we do know. Mentioned our theft by deception where the property obtained as a result is covered in our theft article. Theft by deception. And now, under our forgery article, too, we have a note there, and that was before the commission, that originally in that article we had a section dealing with what we call criminal impersonation. And the subcommittee decided, and the commission agreed with its thinking in that respect, that we shouldn't cover it in that article, and that the only place that you should be concerned, really, was with respect to impersonation of a peace officer or some type of public service. And that's why we deleted it from the forgery draft, carried it over here. And at that time, we discussed this situation involving fraternal organizations and decided to delete those.
What you're saying is we don't presently have another section of the draft to cover this one?
No, we don't. But we don't have a draft anyplace that covers the fraternal organization type of misrepresentation that Mr. Chandler brought up. Because we have not picked that up anyplace because of a prior decision by the commission.
I move to approve section 9.
I've heard the motion. Any further discussion?
Can I hear someone tell me the definition I heard when I first said about public servant? Is it strictly any employee? Or
it's from the bribery section.
You got bribery section. It's very broad.
I don't know.
We're going to redo that, aren't we?
Yeah, bribery is still in the subcommittee. Well, not the definitions.
Well, we haven't approved it yet.
And the definitions of bribery have been approved by the commission.
Yeah, but the draft itself is still pretty good. Do you want me to read the definition of public servant?
Yes, would you?
Now, the copy I have here, this preliminary draft number 3, and this was amended. Well, maybe we ought to get that. Get the tentative draft. Because because there was an amendment in there. I don't show.
Well, he
can. Can I ask a question? What if you don't have a theft or somewhere that statute says that covers this kind of harm?
We do have a section that covers this if it involves the attainment of property. Require a different, another element.
I agree with
you. They have to attain property. This one does it. This just says it doesn't act. Okay, now the definition of public servant that's been approved by the commission, which appears in bribery and corrupt influences, section 1, subsection 2. Public servant includes A, a public officer or employee of the state or any political subdivision thereof, or of any governmental instrumentality within the state. B, a person serving as an advisor, consultant, or assistant at the request or direction of the state, any political subdivision thereof, or of any governmental instrumentality within the state. C, a person nominated, elected, or appointed to become a public servant, although not yet occupying a position. And D, jurors.
It's on far enough. We lost my aspect here. About the second sentence. Well, we could exclude jurors from this. You couldn't impersonate a juror.
Roger, do any of the other codes include impersonations of the type that appear on page 56?
None of the recent revisions, for example, Michigan, for example, the Minnesota code, which passed 1962, that they limited police, military officer, or public official. They also required intent to mislead, not intent to mislead.
Don't we have a public official under their definition would be the same as a public servant under ours,
yeah.
So it's just as broad as ours.
Now, New York, under their criminal impersonations statute, sub 2, pretends to be a representative of some person or organization and doesn't act in such a pretending capacity with intent to obtain a benefit or injury from fraud or not.
Pretends to be a public servant, which is as broad as I.
Doesn't it disturb any of the members of the commission that this eliminates or exempts anyone from impersonating themselves as a member of an organization for the purpose of gaining entrance, for example, to take advantage of the facilities that exist there or something?
I don't think it hurts the Elks Club that much if somebody goes in there.
Well, not that it's necessarily an Elks Club, but any type of journal organization.
Well, I mean, this is the only way you can
boot him out.
Go in and buy a lunch or buy a drink, yeah, and somebody has to boot him out.
That's what I can't understand about this statute. It just seems to me, all right, you say if he injures a person. Well, he injures a person, and he was presumably he'd be impersonating a police officer. Well, he obviously was not a police officer, so there's no sense. Obtain a benefit. Well, that seems a benefit to be proper. I don't know, I just. I'm a little curious as to why this kind of conduct isn't covered, but I think almost any situation you could cover would be covered under
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Well, what about a situation of a guy that doesn't intend to obtain a benefit? He doesn't intend to injure anybody. He doesn't intend to defraud anybody. He just likes to wear a cop's uniform. Now, there are cases like that. It seems to me that we should not put such a severe burden upon the prosecution to establish a crime for impersonating a peace officer.
Well, but if he does an act though that has a tendency or possibility of injuring someone, that would certainly make a prima facie case.
What if he's just driving down the street?
If he's driving down the street in a police uniform, who's he hurting?
And he's
got a red bubble on his car.
Okay. Who's he hurt?
The potential is there. Isn't
but
it?
if he starts to do an act, then he's going to fall within the statute.
He just drive down the street with a red bubble on his car. Probably slow down traffic, save somebody's life.
How about these guys that
potential for rape beyond and just walking down the street?
Well, there's that potential there with an old man walking down the street.
Draw a wallet.
I think. Was there a motion?
Yep.
The only thing good about this is it repeals 26 sections of existing law.
Call the roll. All right, I move we approve it. That's the second motion. Call the roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sandra Burns?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Brock?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
Yeah.
Spalding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Carry. What about
Chandler?
Were you on the daily side this time?
Yeah. That's why I'm smiling.
Right. Does that complete that complete perjury and related offenses? All right, parties to crime. John, who wants to take that?
Raj, my friend. This was out of Senator Burns' subcommittee.
I was very happy to let Don do it.
Right,
I move we approve it all, Carolyn.
Well, I have a few questions.
Okay, this whole article deals with accomplices.
Mr. Chairman, could I suggest we take a recess or something? We're seeming to be getting short of membership.
All right, fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
great. It's 11:30. Do you want to take your lunch break and convene at 1?
That or something, but I'm going to
have an idea. Let's eat downstairs. Let's do that then.
That's a good idea.
We're down to 4 or 5 members.
Yeah, we'll reconvene at 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know Dr. McCoy and Barry.
From 22 years ago.
All right, Mr. Chairman.
The House is not very well represented right now.
They never are, Frank. And it's this way of session, Frank, since they're absent.
And the Senate has to do all, straighten out all those problems.
Yeah. This draft of parties sets out the principles relating to criminal liability through complicity. It deals with accomplices. The draft does not treat the matter of accessories after the fact, which is dealt with in another draft, dealing with interference with governmental administration. This draft really is complementary to our draft on criminal liability. But this sets out not the principles relating to conduct on the part of the individual who's being charged with the crime, but sets forth the manner in which he may become criminally liable for a criminal act committed by someone else. Section 1 states that a person is guilty of a crime if it is committed by his own conduct or by the conduct of another person for which he is criminally liable, or both. Now, this section then has to be read with the section that immediately follows, section 2. But before we go on to that, probably I should point out that this section does not work any change in what has been the law in Oregon for many years and with respect to principles. That is, that makes no distinction between a principal and an accessory before the fact. This was, of course, the law, the common law, did recognize the distinction.
this was abolished by statute in Oregon many, many years ago. And so this draft continues that concept that there is no difference between a principal and an accessory. One thing I should mention, and I was going over the minutes of the subcommittee of June 13th this year, once this draft was considered, the question was brought up then, I think it was a good idea to mention this now, that the question was raised whether or not this works a change in the law with respect to misdemeanor offenses. And the answer to that is no, it does not. Oregon statute 161.210 provides that there are no accessories in misdemeanors. We are not changing that in this draft, but these provisions that we have set out in the parties to crime article apply equally to felonies or misdemeanors. And then on the first two pages of your draft, we have set out the existing statutes dealing with principals and accessories. Now, those are terms that I have not used in this draft. We do not talk in terms of principals, although the concept is the same. I would think before you decide on what you want to do with Section 1, you want to look at Section 2, in which we go ahead and explain the ways in which one can become criminally liable for the conduct of another person. And it provides that he's criminally liable if, one, he is made so by the statute defining the crime, which is perfectly obvious, or with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of a crime, he does one of the following: solicits or commands another or such other person to commit the crime, or aids or abets or agrees or attempts to aid or abet such other person in planning or committing a crime, or having a legal duty to prevent the commission of a crime, fails to make an effort that he's legally required to do. Now, this language is going to sound familiar to some of you, should, because it's very similar to the language with respect to soliciting or commanding. It's the same as that appearing in the Inchoate Crimes article prepared by Professor Platt. Now, the distinction here is that insofar as the defendant is concerned in a case where he might be charged as a result of this section, His conduct in soliciting or commanding may be the same, but whereas under your Inchoate Crimes, you do not have a completed crime as such. You're still in the attempt or solicitation area of the conduct. Here we do have a situation, this contemplates a situation where as a result of the solicitation or the assistance by this individual, another person has gone ahead and committed a completed crime. As far as the derivation of these two sections, they're basically the same as the Model Penal Code, except I have used the words criminally liable rather than legally accountable. We felt that this was more precise since we're talking about criminal liability, and it was brought out in the subcommittee that a person might be legally accountable for another's conduct without getting into the area of criminal conduct. So we felt that this language is preferable. Similar provisions to these sent out in the draft are contained in Michigan and Illinois and most of your modern codes. And we go on in subsequent sections setting out defenses and exemptions and other types of provisions dealing with criminal liability, namely criminal liability of corporations. But for the purposes of discussion, I felt that it would help to discuss sections 1 and 2 together, and then we could move on into the area of defense.
Is the conduct defined anywhere?
Yeah, it is.
Did it mean an act or omission?
Yeah, under our general principles of liability, and that was the reason we used that terminology, conduct, is because we do have that defined.
So you mean an act or omission?
Mr. Spalding didn't like the definition because it said the act concludes not the act. Page 4 of the minutes.
Conduct under culpability draft defines conduct means an act or omission and its accompanying mental state. And then our culpable mental states are further defined as being intentional, knowing, reckless, or criminally negligent.
Yeah, it didn't take more about 3 hours to arrive at that nice little simple statement either.
In order to be responsible for your conduct, you have to have an accompanying mental state.
Subsection 1, for example, he is made criminally liable by the statute defining the crime. This, in effect, restates existing law. We don't have a statute on this, but case law is that a principal may be held liable for the acts of an agent done under the authority of the principal. Number 2. Do not change existing law, as far as I can tell, whether it's by aiding or abetting, or by virtue of some conspiracy.
Is there a solicitation defined?
The Concord crime, March 69, minutes, March 1.
Well, we haven't taken the color crime to the full commission yet.
No. That's what the discussion is.
But I do not define the term solicits in this draft.
Yeah, no, I
nor did we define aids or abets. And I set out the reason for that in the commentary that these terms have been interpreted a number of times by Oregon case law and have a fairly fixed meaning in the law. And we have, for example, State versus Rosser, which is a case I know Spalding is quite familiar with. Define an aider and abettor as one who advises, counsels, procures, or encourages another to commit a crime, though not personally present at the time and place of the commission of the offense.
State versus Stark defined the bet as meaning to countenance, assist, or give aid, and to include knowledge of the wrongful purpose of the perpetrator, the counsel, and encouragement of the crime. Now, under sub 3, this would cover the individual who has a legal duty to do something to prevent the commission of a crime. And I've cited on page 5 a case, a Michigan case, in which an individual, a man, had hired a man to commit adultery with his wife so that he could have grounds for divorce. The wife wouldn't cooperate with this individual, and she was raped. The husband knew what was going on and made no attempt to interfere, and he was held criminally liable.
But that's not under the having a legal duty part.
Yeah, I think it is.
I thought your last example on the police officer was more precisely the legal duty part.
Well, there you have the statutory, more of a statutory duty on the part of the police officer than you do. Well, in the case of the husband, he would have no statutory duty.
Well, why would you have to approach that, Don? Why don't you insist on the solicits or aids or abets section, A or B?
Well,
that's
because the question came up in that case that there was no plan on the part of the husband for this individual to commit rape on his wife. All he had solicited the individual to do was to have intercourse with his wife.
Well, was he legally required to come to her aid once he learned of the transfer of intent or change of intent?
The court there felt that he was.
They must have had a special statute for that.
Don, I know in the subcommittee on the sexual offenses we were talking last time about increasing the age from 10 to 18, and I was wondering, considering subsection C there, if you had a 17-year-old girl and a 19-year-old brother, subsection C of having a duty to prevent. Well, we're talking on the subcommittee, so it's fine for the increased age of consent.
Is there more of a legal duty on the part of the parent to commit to prevent the commission of an offense by his daughter or son than there is on ordinary individual who sees a crime in the course of commission?
Under the proposed Chandler amendment to this section, we
you know, we commonly have in this situation, rape on a daughter situation. So if the wife stands idly by, has nothing to prevent it, she just goes along with it so as not to lose her name, she doesn't report it to a party. Very, very common. And in one such case recently, it was so, well, these people, it was so terrible, man was out on appeal bond for rape on a daughter.
What's his name?
Hurt. Mm-hmm. And she left him. So we finally charged her with contributing. And that was, we're out of ballpark in that. It does seem to me that that's a situation of criminal liability which does not pick up.
Well,
we should be.
Should be, but is it?
Yeah, what
is it?
By what authority is it now?
Well, where is there anything in this statute says that there is a duty to prevent in that type of a factual situation?
2C, having a legal duty to prevent the commission of a crime.
Where does it say that there is a legal duty to prevent it?
Well, I'm wondering, is that a statutory duty of a parent to look for the welfare of the children?
Well, then, this would bring in the parent-child situation. But it wouldn't bring in the stranger situation. Is that
why
correct?
Have a legal duty
for the husband
good,
wife?
Is this a good Samaritan statute? Crime committed in front of me?
No, no, this isn't a good Samaritan statue. It isn't intended of it.
Yeah, but we talked about it.
The way Jake describes it, it sounds like a prodigal son statue.
Well, I don't know. Probably, who has these legal duties?
And I don't think you need to. Or do you want to try to define them in this article?
Well, somebody's going.
Well, that's what you want is vague crimes.
No, we're not creating any crimes in this article, Mr. Johnson. The purpose of this article is not to commit, to create any crimes, vague or otherwise.
But you can't, Don, you can't vote.
I'm totally kidding, Don.
Can you vote on subsection C without knowing? I mean, I'd be hesitant to vote on that without knowing who has a legal duty to do what. Like I say, I'd be concerned about a mother and a father, if you're just an 18-year-old millionaire, the best thing in the world they can do for their child is to acquiesce in the relationship in hopes of matrimony.
There's
a difference between acquiescence and intent, and that element I think we're taking a little side of here.
What's the intent
to promote, facilitate? Now, acquiescence is not necessarily the intent to promote or facilitate.
Well, but George, look at page 5, the case cited for the escape, where the police officer by just sitting by while the escape is going on, it's all within the purview of apparently, just like in Spencer.
Who comes out
of the talking about any affirmative act? What about failing that?
Well, that's a failing act. All right, Mr. Chandler.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I refer to the first 15 pages of the subcommittee minutes of June 13, 1969, where we discussed this in some detail.
I happen to think we need
some sort of statute. Creates a legal duty for people to assist in the prevention of a crime when they know the crime is being committed.
Say, we did have, we discussed that under reporting to police and so on, but not actively stopping it.
Yeah. This was the duty of a citizen, creating a duty on the part of a citizen to inform authorities and crime which he either was being committed or knew was about to be committed.
So that would be the offense.
That's what they were really not what we were shooting at, but what I was shooting at.
Yeah. That's a crime. Yeah. And Don, didn't we act upon that in some connection, this duty to report, inform police authorities and so on?
Well, we discussed
it. Did we just discuss it?
On infinitum.
It's been discussed more than once, and at length, 15 pages of minutes.
Judge Burns mentioned a point, it's a crime, statutory crime to give intoxicating liquor to a minor. So his 18-year-old daughter at the dinner table, and she served wine. He has a legal duty to prevent the commission of that crime. He fails to take any action.
Isn't there some exception there in the home or in the presence of the parents?
That's right. So that's a specific exemption that you're furnishing.
But you know, whether or not
you're in the business, you just can't go out there.
We're talking about legal duty existing. All this says is having a legal duty to prevent the commission of a crime.
He failed.
So
we're not.
What difference does it make? First, they have to establish that there was a legal duty to prevent the commission of a crime.
Yeah.
If there was, they would come under this. If they didn't, they would not. So it's really a separate question that's not involved with this statute.
And I move that we approve section 2.
Well,
Carl?
In that respect, that was a question I was concerned about. I hated to vote on it without knowing what the legal duties were. But then Don noted that in this People versus Chapman, where did they come up with the legal duties?
That Michigan case?
Yeah.
I don't know, except Don hasn't reported enough of it here for us to know.
But maybe under Michigan law, whether it's case law or statutory law, there was a duty of some sort.
There wasn't a statutory duty in that case.
It was an 1886 case.
Well, all right. Suppose you have a police officer, you've got a crime being committed, murder, and he fails to act. Actually, the reason he failed to act is scared.
I think that's covered out.
How would you show the intent to promote or facilitate, though?
Excuse that officer from being an aider and abettor.
How would you show the intent to promote or facilitate the man?
To Lee's example a bit, what about police officer goes ahead and makes a buy or sets up in the form of one and makes a buy in their body?
Well, he wouldn't have the legal duty to prevent him in that situation.
I mean, he should.
But my point is that this is not the place for the discussion of that particular aspect of this problem.
Right. All right. I'm trying to get at, here we are imposing criminal liability on inaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you run into all kinds of problems when you start doing that.
Which is the sublime part to the ridiculous, which is the notary public, who doesn't require a showing of a birth certificate or some identification before he notarizes an instrument, which is in fact a forgery. He had a legal duty, I assume, to prevent the commission, that is, the acknowledgement of someone's signature who was not the person represented on the document. Does he then have a legal liability under sub C?
Can't prove the intent to promote or facilitate.
You still have to show the guilty intent part of the individual.
The point is, though, that we have other things that cover police officers, for example.
Well, there are pages 4 to 15 that may know the number of. Illustrations. Boy, we got them all in there.
Well, I'm very reluctant to impose criminal
liability. Well,
you're not doing that.
Let's just suppose that there is not a single illustration, there's not an existing case where there is a legal duty to prevent the commission of a crime.
Then this says nothing.
This says nothing until such time as a law is passed which imposes a legal duty upon someone to pass. Consequently, I submit that this...
Well, we know whether some of our present laws don't impose that duty. That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, if it does, this is covered.
What about a fire warden?
Well, what they are, that's...
What about a fire warden in a lookout tower that has a responsibility by virtue of the job that he has to report fires, and he sees somebody down, an arsonist down there starting a fire, and he fails to... make the effort that he's legally required to make. That's a situation that he'd be covered.
And he'd still have,
but
he'd
he's
have
not
to
covered
promote
under this statute.
The,
well, because
that's
not with the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of arson.
It might be.
It might be. But,
well, I mean, if it is.
But the point that Tony's making is that we are not talking here about a substantive crime. We're talking about principles.
Under which substantive crimes can be punished?
Right. And
parties.
Right. Parties to crime. And we shouldn't confuse it.
Well, I'm not quite sure if I buy that.
Well, it's just like the old statute that accessories before are principles, and that's all you say.
That's right.
You didn't say principles to what?
We have a statutory presumption that a person intends the normal
ordinary consequences of a voluntary act.
Voluntary act. Well, again, I'm concerned about the intent part in sub 2. If he, by inaction, does nothing, does his doing nothing in connection with that presumption show the necessary intent?
I know Frank could answer that question.
No, it depends, though, the presumption usually is given upon the proof of the commission of an unlawful act. The presumption that he acted with an unlawful intent.
That's the separate one from
the But that wouldn't necessarily mean that he had criminal intent, even though he presumed the intent the ordinary consequences.
Of his voluntary act, now the ordinary consequences of the commission of a crime, that doesn't, by his inaction, his voluntary inaction, is he going to intend the outcome of that? Am I torturing that for you guys?
Well, if I don't think it goes anywhere from here.
If your view's upheld, I don't need my own.
Jay?
Well, you know, there is an analogous body of law when you talk about, at least in the field of homicide, you know, of murder by failure to act, and by a person with a duty to act. So, I mean, there is an analogous body of law, and George probably knows this body a lot better than I do, but my memory of it is that, at least in that area, that the courts find duty to act only where there's a rather specific statutory command to act. It's not just by virtue of having no moral obligation to act. And the only statutory type appropriate relationship here is parent and child that I can think of. We do have a murder case up now, as a matter of fact, about a mother who murdered her child by failure to act. But beyond parent and child, I'm not aware of anything. What I'm trying to say is, it's not been expanded beyond statutory duties, to my knowledge, to some sort of moral good Samaritan requirement in the law. And I'm a little bit, I imagine it might apply to husband and wife, I don't know. But certainly that would be parent and child, and I don't know how it's
called. Well, this is confined to the legal duty to prevent.
Right. And I think it's perfectly appropriate that you got that clear a statutory duty to have such a provision in the parties. The wife I mentioned, I think, is equally guilty of that rape on the child as with the husband. Morally guilty.
Well, there's no chance of confusing our use of this legal duty with the tort law legal duty. If so, I think it would be dangerous.
We're speaking only in a criminal sense.
I know where you're trying to, but I wonder if there is danger that we
make it clear that we don't intend that.
The case that Jake has been talking about has been the tort legal duty that usually ties the person to the criminal homicide. It is a civil duty that's carried into the criminal law to establish this kind of crime by virtue of being a parent.
Such as what?
Oh, a common law relationship, parent and child, doesn't have to be statutory. Some cases, I think there's one case, goes in the relationship of the mistress. If it's continuing, it's like over a long period of time, if there's a duty to protect, by osmosis of the common law. But it's not a criminal duty, certainly, and it's not statutory necessarily.
Well, Bruce, this says legal duty to do what? To prevent the commission of a crime.
Yeah.
You're thinking of a traffic offense.
Yeah.
Which is
duty to use reasonable care, not to hurt anybody else.
Well, that is not commission of a crime.
Well, I didn't mean to say that. I thought it was, but want to be sure that.
I don't think so. It's having a legal duty not to prevent someone from being negligent, but to prevent the commission of a crime.
Well, sure, this is what bothers me. I mean, there's a considerable difference of opinion as to what this refers to.
When he fails to make an effort,
there's not much disagreement here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's different.
Mr. Chairman, on the sexual deal I was talking about, in the last session we had, there was a thought that it increased the age of consent to 18 for the girl and retained the 3-year differential. And if this would pass and that would pass, and it would appear that a 19-year-old college male student, 17-year-old female college student who engaged in sexual intercourse with the acquiescence of her parents, that they would be guilty of statutory rape.
Well, did they acquiesce with the intent to promote or facilitate?
Well, you're talking about Jake's case, though, where the father, or the mother, wasn't it Jake, who acquiesced to the father committing rape of a daughter?
The acquiesced in the sexual intercourse.
We have some other sections in here that get to this question of
not being within the class of persons covered by the statute that specifically deal with that. For example, under Section 3, the crime as defined can be committed only by a particular class or class of persons to which the defendant does not belong. And he may be personally, legally incapable of committing the crime in his own right, but this is no defense to a charge of commission of the crime as an accomplice to someone else committing. In other words,
Don, will you? You still haven't defined for me or told me who the devil we're talking about. It's a legal duty. At one point you tell me about somebody and then everybody disagrees over it. You take a police officer, I have a question whether I'm going to say a police officer is guilty of murder because he didn't stop the crime. You know, these sort of things. Maybe he should be guilty of malfeasance in office. But
of course, your police officer wouldn't be guilty unless he had the intent to assist in the commission of the crime. The mere fact that he didn't prevent it wouldn't make him guilty under this statute.
Wouldn't make him guilty of that crime. He might be guilty of failing to make an arrest for something he sees committed in his presence or something like that. There isn't a statute like that. That's a different thing than we're talking about here.
Yes. Well, you wouldn't indict anybody under this specific statute. Isn't that what we're really talking about?
Oh, you couldn't.
No, this doesn't charge anybody with a crime.
You're going to have to find a separate statute imposing liability for a given set of circumstances or activities.
Yeah, that other statute created a crime.
Well, Don,
that's right.
You recall that.
Second crime, Jeff.
Hesitate to bring this up. You know, we had extensive, you're right, Bob, 15 full pages.
Was Johnson on the subcommittee?
No,
Chandler.
I wanted to substitute the word statutory for legal. Mm-hmm. I understand you now. You're saying that this relates only to a statutory
duty. No, I'm not saying that. I didn't say it relates only to statutory duty. Somebody else said that.
Well, Bruce made the point, and I think the minutes should be clear on this, that we don't want to confuse this with the legal duty that we have in a tort case. All right, so draw the line of demarcation between these two legal duties for me.
Well, I don't see how you can say that your duty, in a, as far as it relates to a tort, is at all anything like the duty to prevent the commission of a crime. Your liability in tort law is vicarious liability and this type of thing. Is what you're
doing. Can we have a 5-minute lesson?
Well, I think that Mr. Spalding can best perform that feat.
Everybody has a duty to, with reasonable care, with respect to his fellow man, not to injure him by either doing that which a reasonably prudent person would not do or failing to do that which a reasonably prudent person would have done.
Under the same or similar
circumstances. Under the same or similar circumstances as at the time of the act.
And that in the short
is a failure to act, you must have a duty to act.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Did you get that, Miller?
This means that I can't drive my car down the road.
You can unless there's a statute. You can drive right by that wrecked car and that person lying there. It's a statute.
Right.
Right. It says you must stop.
Right.
The tort thing that we're talking about is I can't drive my car down the road so fast it endangers other people.
Well, that's
with or without a statute.
Without a statute. With or without a statute.
That's common law.
And this is what you're trying not to mix up in this.
Yeah.
This is uncommon law.
Chairman, let me still get water a little
bit.
How about the girl that's under the age of consent who voluntarily participates in the statutory rape? She can be charged under this because she promoted the commission of a crime and she had the duty to prevent it.
There's a section subsequent to them that takes her out.
It would take her out?
Yeah. Two or three.
Why don't we go by this? We'll come back to it.
We may answer some of these questions if we look at some of these other sections.
Johnson, leave.
Duck by me again. All right, now under section three, we set out two situations in which there won't be any defense to the individual. And that is that it's no defense where there's criminal liability based under section two. It's no defense that one, such other person has not been prosecuted for or convicted of any crime based upon the conduct in question, or has been convicted of a different crime or degree of crime. I might add that that doesn't change our existing law at all. Sub two, the crime as defined can be committed only by a particular class or classes of persons to which the defendant does not belong, and he is for that reason legally incapable of committing the crime in an individual capacity.
That's Tom's problem.
Well,
husband.
No, the girl is incapable of committing a crime of statutory rape.
Yeah, and we also have another section that deals more specifically with Tom's hypothetical, I think, and that is under section four. He's a victim of the crime. But examples I set out under the commentary under subsection two. A, who is not a public servant, aides B, who is a public servant, to receive a bribe. If you have a statute prohibiting bribe receiving by officials, A, who is not an official, couldn't be guilty in his own right under the statute, but he could be guilty as an accomplice.
Well, B. Or where the woman helps some guy rape another girl.
Yeah, right.
She could be guilty of rape. We had a case like that not too long ago.
What about a mother who's aborted?
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how this would deal with a mother who was aborted. Because, you know, the Supreme Court agonized over the Barnett case. That was pretty important.
This comes under section four.
Yeah, I talked about that under section four, I think, Jake. State versus Barnett was the case I had in mind. That involved a question of whether the woman who had the abortion was killed.
Are there any is there any discussion with respect to section three, page six?
Well, we're going back.
We're going back, coming back later to two.
Yeah, and then go on with these as we go back to two. We're just getting an overall look now. Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't mention here in section whether the principal has been acquitted.
Or he hasn't been convicted.
Well, that's subsection
one.
Back to co-defendant is acquitted without preventing conviction. Thank you.
I think that's covered when you say that he hasn't been convicted.
Well,
you just say it.
This case does.
Oh, yeah. So
we mean
that
he's been
acquitted. It's still.
Question maybe I'm reaching. Another Supreme Court decision where the guy shot with one bullet and killed two people, and he was acquitted on one, the death on one, and then tried again on the second one and convicted. And they said that that couldn't be because the prior determination of innocence had resolved that issue. Now, if you were charging an accomplice with aiding and abetting a principal, and the principal's trial has already been held, and a jury has determined that he did not commit that act, is that going to cause any problems?
No.
I'd say no.
No, because we changed that rule by statute here. It makes no difference that he has not been convicted. He's been tried and acquitted.
That was a practical matter.
That was just well, falling apart. Same parties.
Same parties.
These are different parties.
Well, that really was not a big
one. think that's what they said. But,
on the basis of their prior jury determination that they determined to be a nut.
Between the same parties, yeah, I think they used that term rather respectfully.
Well, as it was said in the minutes, Mr. Spaulding observes that you have a tough time convincing the jury to convict if they knew the principal was acquitted. At the same time, it's proper that every man's case stands.
That's why the district attorney would argue with some vehemence that the fact of acquittal is not relevant.
You mean you're going to let the jury know about that, Your Honor?
Just
for
the
course. Irrelevant.
Did that fellow get a medal for marksmanship?
Nobody was conservative, Dale.
You see anything other than that, Frank, that's radically wrong with this? Let's turn to section 4.
Section 4 provides, except as otherwise provided by the statute defining the crime, a person is not criminally liable for conduct of another constituting a crime if, one, he is a victim of that crime, or, two, the crime is so defined that his conduct is necessarily incidental thereto. Now, point out in the commentary under sub 1, unless the statute which states the crime provides the conduct, and there might be instances where that might be. A victim of the criminal act does not share the guilt of the actor. Thus, a victim of the blackmail plotted pays over money, even though he aids the commission of the crime, or the girl under the age of consent and statutory rape, even though she solicits the criminal act, are not being guilty of the substantive offense.
Well, it's statutory rape because she's being unable to consent.
Yeah.
But I think a person might be able to be just as guilty as the next guy, and he didn't know that he was the pigeon when he committed his act. And just the fact that he is the victim. Maybe shouldn't excuse his guilty act.
Well, that's why we left an out here to deal with if there were instances in which the legislature wanted to specifically say, well, this individual in this kind of a case should be held guilty, that the statute could specifically provide for that.
My main concern isn't so much the definition of liability as it is the practical problem of the testimony of the accomplice. Is he an accomplice or not? It seems he needs some room to play there. For example, a woman who was aborted. And secondly, even the investigation stage, let's say you talk to an aborted woman or a rape victim or something of that nature, statutory rape victim, can they claim the Fifth legitimately? Well, if you make them an accomplice by your statute, yes, they can. In that case, will never be properly investigated or prosecuted. I'm not really very worried about prosecuting a stat rape victim because it's just not done. I'm not too worried about prosecuting or defining as an accomplice but for fear of prosecution an aborted mother because that's not done. I am worried about about what goes on in the courtroom in the trial of the primary principle. And you need some help in the law, and this statute seems to do it really by codifying how the law reads now. Although there may be some moral responsibility on the person's part, I don't think it's terribly necessary to bring them into the operation of the criminal law.
Well, the commentary from the Penal Code is on page 9 here. I think that probably explains some aspects of that quite well.
Now, and on page 10, I noted State versus Barnett, which was a manslaughter by abortion. And the court there, the argument was that the mother was an accomplice. Of the testimony statute, and the defendant cannot be convicted. The court affirmed that conviction, and I'm sure Jake's very familiar with this case. The court said it's our opinion that it was not the intention of the legislature by the passage of the statute to make the consent solicitation of the mother culpable, and such actions had not been previously so considered. The fact that certain actions have been held to constitute the aiding and abetting of crimes other than manslaughter by abortion does not result in a necessary conclusion that historical precedent must be disregarded, and that the consent solicitation of the mother should be treated as sufficiently concerning her commission of crimes that she is an accomplice.
In that very case, I had to persuade the mother's lawyer not to advise her to take the fifth. It is a very practical problem in this case.
And that's the reason for the kind of language we use in sub 2. That it might be a little strained to characterize the mother in this Barnett case as a victim, but her conduct would be necessarily incidental to the commission of the crime.
Well, the problem, of course,
that we wrestle with, I'm still not very satisfied with the whole thing, is who is the victim and who is not. Now, the victim of a statutory rape, that's pretty easy to decide on. But the victim of a forcible rape is far more, but
you're about to
keep moving along, and pretty soon you get into somebody who's who's really not quite a victim, but becomes an accomplice.
Like the aborted mother.
The aborted mother.
Reasoning on that is, it's important to
the fear that Chandler has really is the thing that this resolves.
Right.
I like
it. All right, let's move on.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yes.
What do you do with these cases which are cited here, State versus Nice and State versus Stanley, in which they hold that State versus Stanley, they hold that it is a jury question whether or not a 15-year-old boy was an accomplice in a sodomy prosecution, and similarly in State versus Nice, whether or not the 12-year-old boy was an accomplice in a sodomy prosecution. The thing that I don't understand, I'm not objecting to, but I don't understand, does this section 4 sub 1 equate victim with non-accomplice, as that term has been defined by our decisions? In other words, if you are an accomplice, does that make you not a victim? Or under this section, do you even talk about whether or not the person involved is an accomplice? Because if you can't be a victim if you were an accomplice, I want us to be sure, knowing whether we're doing away with the rule in these cases or reaffirming it or changing it somehow. And when you have commentary talking about an accomplice, it sounds to me like maybe you do equate victim with non-accomplice status. I don't know.
Normally you'd say
that a 12-year-old boy is a victim of a sodomy case, but the case law points out that he may be an accomplice within the meaning of necessity for accomplice instruction and so on. Does the fact that the jury might find that he is an accomplice, does that prevent him from being a victim?
But even though he is an accomplice, maybe he can't be prosecuted.
Well, I think we ought to clear it up, because what these cases...
Isn't our new permission grant really make that boy clearly in a protected class, Judge, so that he can't be an accomplice to the crime of sodomy?
You mean because we say
isn't forced sexual intercourse now, doesn't that include this 12-year-old boy in the sodomy case?
Well, yes, or make it 15. Make it somebody whom you would normally think of as a victim, someone who would be of the age that he would be criminally culpable himself, and yet would have the protection of our sexual offenses draft, that is, one upon whom forcible sodomy could not be committed, or consensual sodomy could not be committed. Is he a victim?
Well, I would say what we're doing is we're making out some things like sodomy. Both parties can be tried and convicted. Say the younger boy could be tried for his own acts that he committed, but he couldn't be tried for the older man's acts. So he would not be an accomplice to the older man, but if he performed any acts himself.
I think that's the distinction.
So I would say that by this, we are doing away with any question that would arise in those cases. And we're saying that clearly he's not an accomplice.
Particularly when we go adopt this sexual article, which will become a part of this. But I think that's a good analysis of Frank's. I think that's what it is.
What you're saying, he's not criminally liable for the actions of the 22-year-old.
Upon his person. So he's not an accomplice.
Right.
Well, because he can't be tried for the other guy's acts. But he may be committing acts himself.
Well, then you're doing away with the law in these cases.
Right, yes. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Okay, I want to make sure you know that you're doing that.
With respect to sodomy cases, but we want to remember that what we'll be retaining in our sex offenses is really a form of statutory sodomy because of the age of the child. If he is above a certain age and it's consensual, it isn't going to be criminal anyway.
But if he's below a certain age, even though it's consensual, it's going to be a crime.
And he's going to be the victim of the crime because he is deemed incapable of consenting to the act under our
So you will be doing away with this, with the effect of these cases, will you not?
With the effect of the sodomy cases, but because of our definition of sodomy.
All right, you want to go to, is there any further comment on section 4? Well, I don't think that section 5, criminal liability of corporations, will shed much light upon the problems we've been having in these previous sections.
Mr. Chairman, I should mention one other thing.
Criminal liability of corporate.
On page 11 of the draft, I noted that preliminary draft number 1 contained a section allowing the affirmative defense of renunciation, which was somewhat along the same lines that Professor Platt allowed for in the court of crimes, although the requirements were a little more stringent, the kind of affirmative acts that the defendant would have to show. The subcommittee decided that they didn't want to retain that, frankly, I think that it does not upset the format of Professor Platt's draft on court crimes. You don't necessarily have to have both, but we did want to take a look at it, since this is allowed in some non-model penal code.
You agree with that, Professor Platt?
Yes, I do.
Well, let's go to corporations.
Renunciation
tie. Is that a tie vote?
Yeah.
All right, well, section 5 is merely a list of definitions. Under sub 1, that is, we define an agent, we define high managerial agents. Then under sub 2, we set forth the bases for criminal liability on the part of corporations. Now, this is new law. It made a lot of changes. These are based mainly on New York and Michigan and the Model Penal Code. There, at the present time, we don't have any statute dealing specifically, or generally, that is, with criminal liability. There are some specific statutes that relate to corporations. For one thing, under ORS 161010, definitions that apply throughout the criminal statutes, the definition of person includes corporations as well as natural persons. Procedural statute is noted here. The plea of guilty is an indictment against a corporation and put in by counsel. State versus Fraser case I cited. Blue sky law of crime. Of course, there you have specific statutory liability because of the nature of the crime. But one case, a notable case, of course, this is the Roseburg explosion case. State versus Pacific Powder Company, 1961 Oregon case, in which Oregon followed the majority view and refused to extend corporate criminal liability to crimes involving personal violence, such as homicide and manslaughter. Now, the draft does not intend to change this, but we are trying to set forth some guidelines that we hope would assist the courts later on in attempting to construe certain statutes, whether or not there could be criminal liability on the part of corporations. Now, under sub 2, section 5, you have vicarious liability concept, respondeat superior. Under A, the conduct constituting the offense is engaged in by an agent of the corporation while acting within the scope of his employment and in behalf of the corporation, and the offense is a misdemeanor or a violation. So sub A does not apply to felons. Or the offense is one defined by a statute that clearly indicates a legislative intent to impose criminal liability on corporations. And under B, the conduct constituting the offense consists of an omission to discharge a specific duty of affirmative performance imposed on corporations by law. Or, if under C, if the conduct constituting the offense is engaged in, authorized, solicited, requested, commanded, or knowingly tolerated by the board of directors or a high managerial agent, which under our definitions under sub 1 means an officer of a corporation or any other agent in a position of comparable authority with respect to the formulation of corporate policy or the supervision in a managerial capacity of subordinate employees.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we amend the definition of high managerial agent to be one, the officer of a corporation who has had 6 martinis.
No, oh. No. Who?
How is that?
Drink 6 martinis a day.
6 martinis. I'm sorry.
You heard the motion?
I withdraw it.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. The under sub B, 2 sub B, is there a reason for using the word affirmative performance? Is the conduct constituting the offense consists of omitting to perform a specific duty of affirmative performance? Now, I take it that would be something like
file
your annual report and so on. What about situations in which the duty commanded would not be to do something affirmative, but to refrain from doing something?
Well, by use of the double negative, that would be failing to perform an affirmative.
course, our definition of conduct includes an omission.
Oh, okay.
Before we get into a big
house.
Now, this is an area that the model penal code drafters spent a great deal of time on, and I have set out a lot of their commentary from the model penal code with respect to the rationale behind these kind of penal provisions. And they looked at the deterrent effect, for example, of corporate fines and that sort of thing, and they felt that when a corporation is fined, for example, that their penalty is in effect passed on to the stockholders, and in most cases, the shareholders have not participated in this conduct. They don't have the practical means of supervising the day-to-day activities of the corporate management to prevent this conduct. And they state it may be assumed that ordinarily a corporate agent is not likely to be deterred from criminal conduct by the prospect of corporate liability. When, in any event, he faces the prospect of individually suffering serious criminal penalties for his own act. If the agent cannot be prevented from committing an offense by the prospect of personal liability, he ordinarily will not be prevented by the prospect of corporate liability. Yet the problem cannot be resolved so simply, for there are probably cases in which the economic pressures within the corporate body are sufficiently potent to tempt individuals to hazard personal liability for the sake of company gain, especially when the penalties threatened are moderate, where the offense does not involve behavior condemned as highly as moral. They cite a number of recent cases, fairly recent cases, in which juries have held the corporate defendant liable while acquitting the guilty agents. So this attempts this and section